seated. All right, let's take our Bibles and in the Old Testament be turning together to 1 Samuel chapter 14. We left off at verse 15 a couple of weeks ago. Last week we devoted our time together to prayer, and we will plan to do that on a regular basis at the close of each month. But tonight we pick back up our study in the Old Testament. We'll be picking up at verse 16 of 1 Samuel chapter 14 and focus the rest of our time this evening on the remainder of that chapter. Now, as we're coming back into the text, I want you to remember where we are. We are in the period of the United Kingdom, and Saul is the first king over a unified Israel. So whereas for the last couple or 300 years, Israel has been governed in a tribal and distributed fashion, now a centralized government is being formed under the governance and oversight of a monarchy. And Saul is the kind of king that Israel wants. He's the kind of king that Israel demanded. And in fact, it is this motivation to have a king that will rule them like all the nations around them that God describes in 1 Samuel chapter 8 as a rejection, not of the prophet Samuel, but of the Lord himself. Well, Saul is crowned. He is anointed by Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 10. He is inaugurated as king in chapter 11, chapter 12. He has kind of his coming out party, as it were, as he protects the men of Jabesh-Gilead from the threats of Nahash the Ammonite. And initially, there is great enthusiasm for this new king. But we see things begin to go downhill very quickly. We recognize that Saul is never described in the Old Testament as a man of piety, as a man of true faith. We'll see further evidences of that tonight in chapter 14. In chapter 13, as Saul is preparing to go out to battle against the Philistines, he waits for 7 days, as the prophet Samuel had directed him to do, and then, recognizing that he is losing influence over the people, fearful that his army will scatter and he will lose his advantage in the military conflict, he takes it upon himself to administer a sacrifice apart from the presence of the prophet. And this is the first major failure of Saul as king. And it's such a serious sin that the Lord at that time says, your lineage will not continue. In other words, there will not be a dynasty over the house of Israel that is associated with Saul's family. Now, although Yahweh's decree to terminate such a dynasty in chapter 13 is certainly correct, what we see Jonathan doing in chapter 14 gives us a sense of the king that might have been. And what we see in chapter 14 is really this contrast between Saul and his son Jonathan, who would have been his heir. Jonathan is portrayed in this chapter as wiser, braver, and a more competent leader than his father ever was. In chapter 13 and verse 3 and chapter 14 and verse 1, it is Jonathan who takes the initiative in raiding the Philistine garrison and winning the victory by God's grace. And in contrast to Jonathan's efforts, Saul's efforts seem to be too little and too late, including a very belated expression of piety in this chapter, and what I'm going to term a self-righteous inquisition. Okay? So, at the beginning of chapter 14 that we looked at 2 weeks ago, Jonathan and his armor-bearer launch a raid, as it were, against the Philistine garrison. They do so in just an impossibly reckless way, just from a third party's standpoint. As an observer, you would say, this is a foolish thing to do, Jonathan. He says, let's go out and show ourselves to the Philistines, who are up at the top of this rock face. And they've got the high ground, right? We're going to show ourselves to them. And if they say, come up here, we're going to take that as an indication that God wants them to climb up there and fight them. And so Jonathan and his armor bearer go out. Philistines say, ah, the Hebrews are coming out of the rocks and out of their hiding places. Yeah, come on up here. We want to show you something. Jonathan says, that's fine. Let's go. You know, Jonathan almost comes across like a really confident teenager. He's a grown man at this point, right? He's a wise man. He is a man of faith. And that will become more apparent as 1 Samuel unfolds. And so he and his armor bearer climb up the rock face. They are in a defenseless position, right? They get to the top. And the Philistines don't send out a brigade of troops. Obviously, it's just two men climbing up. But as they get to the top, Jonathan draws his weapon. And he starts knocking Philistines down. And anybody that's not dead, when Jonathan gets done with them, the armor bearer is coming behind and sticking them and making sure that they stay on the ground. Right? And within a short period of time, 20 Philistines are dead. And at this moment, God intervenes. Because it's only by the grace of God that Jonathan survives that climb up that rock face and the initial engagement with the Philistines at the top. But notice verse 15. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Now, it's talking about the people of the Philistines here. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked. And it became a very great panic. Or you may notice a footnote in the ESV or a difference in translation in some other English versions. A great panic from God. This is not the only time. It's not the first time. It's certainly not the last time that we're going to see God do something like this, where He puts His fear upon these people. And He shakes the earth and He shakes their hearts so that Jonathan is not overrun, but rather an advantage is created. And that's where we pick up the story. Begin reading with me in verse 16. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." The ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now while Saul was talking to the priests, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priests, "Withdraw your hand." And Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow. And there was great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So Yahweh saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. There is chaos and commotion in the Philistine camp. And this is not primarily because of Jonathan's raid, even though that is the flashpoint for this chaos. It's because of God's intervention. He is shaking the ground and He is shaking the people. And from his vantage point in the Israelite camp, Saul is able to see this commotion and say, something is going on. Now what's interesting to me is he immediately knows or assumes that some of his men have created a raiding party. That they have taken the initiative, that they have gone out and attacked the garrison. He understands this is the only way to explain what I'm seeing. And so he says, "Count the men." And wouldn't you know it, it's Jonathan and his armor bearer. Maybe I'm reading too much into the text, but Saul does not seem shocked that this is something that his son has done. Maybe because it sounds similar to something that he did at the beginning of chapter 13. Now Saul says, all right, what are we going to do? The very next action might seem to Saul's credit. I'm going to argue that it's not. All right. He asked the priest Ahijah to bring the ark of God. And it says the ark of God would go out with Israel at that time. Now just as an aside, I don't necessarily think we should infer the explicit irreverence in this passage that we saw earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 4. You remember Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's sons, take the Ark of God out with Israel to battle in order to obtain God's blessing by having his magic box, right? So we don't see it quite in that light. But one thing I would suggest is that at the very least, Israel seems not to have learned their lesson, right? Maybe they have it there for the right reasons. Maybe they are seeking God's revelation and guidance in the right way. But notice how Saul interacts with this. He is paralyzed for a moment. There is an advantage, a military advantage on the field of battle. But he's paralyzed for a moment. And so he does what seems to be the godly thing. He says to Ahijah, "Come and ask God what we ought to do." Now, in that case, maybe it was an act of piety, but judging from Saul's general character, I'm more inclined to think that he's just not being a good leader. He just doesn't know what to do. And part of the reason I think that is that as Ahijah is interceding and seeking counsel from the Lord, Saul sees the opportunity unfolding and maybe fearing that it will slip away. He finally just says, never mind, never mind, withdraw your hand, let's go, right? Grabs his men and goes off to battle. He doesn't finish what he began. If it was worth inquiring of the Lord, it was worth waiting for God to answer, right? And that's one of the reasons I think this is indecision on Saul's part, not sincere piety. The Lord is exacerbating the confusion among the Philistines at this time. Notice verse 20. Every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Not only has Jonathan and his armor bearer begun the slaughter, the Philistines are getting into it, but they're killing each other. This is fratricide, right? Again, not the first time, won't be the last time either. God is able to do this kind of thing. We saw it in Judges chapter 6 and 7 in the story of Gideon, where Gideon's men are so fantastically outnumbered, the odds are 135,000 to 300, right? And yet in the dark of the night, with the confusion that God throws the enemy into, they begin killing one another, and that is to the advantage of the Israelites, clearly in this case. Not only that, verse 21, there had been Hebrews who had defected. They had joined the Philistine army. They were apparently mercenaries, for all intents and purposes, right? There's no indication that the Philistines have enslaved them. And after all, if you enslave someone, you wouldn't exactly give them a weapon, right? You're not going to put somebody in the battle line who's an armed soldier that you think is going to harm you, right? These are willing participants. These are willing collaborators until they see that Israel has the advantage. And then they're happy to turn around and start killing Philistines, right? Oh, yeah, we were faithful Israelites all along. Sure, right? And then verse 22, there were other Israelites who were hiding in caves and holes and not coming out to the battle because they assume that Saul and his army are going to get slaughtered. They don't want any part of this. Maybe they're not willing to make a buck off of the Philistine dominance like some of their friends and brothers, but they're not willing to stand with their faithful brothers and fight. And yet now they see that God is giving Israel victory. They're willing to jump into the fray. Now, all of that may seem, again, to Israel's advantage. It may seem like it's a positive thing. That's not how I'm reading it. Maybe I'm misreading it. But what I see is a lack of integrity among the people of Israel. A lack of character. A lack of courage. A lack of real conviction, right? That you want Israelites, Hebrews, who have been collaborators with the Philistines to now rejoin the army, right? And fight on your side? You want people that were unwilling to fight when the odds were against them to now suddenly join in the battle when they think they've got a chance to win? See, I think what you're seeing is the character of the people. And it's the character of the people that requested a king like they have. In other words, Saul is a reflection of Israel's moral and spiritual condition. And just FYI, very often, not always, but very often, that's the way it works. The leaders of the nation reflect the nation that put them in power, that wanted them in power, right? Especially in a situation like ours where leaders are elected, right? Well, here, this is a king, and yet it's the king that they have chosen. This is the king we want. But you see a lack of character on Saul's part. You see a lack of conviction on the Israelites' part. And yes, they are experiencing victory here. Verse 23, Yahweh saved Israel that day. And this is the blessing in all of this, right? If I'm correct in how I'm reading this, it's not complimentary to Saul. It's not complimentary to the nation. And yet, God is not abandoning His people. Thank God for that, right? That the lack of character in the nation, the lack of integrity in their leadership, does not mean that God does not bless them. God is keeping His promises. He is being faithful even when the people are faithless. Thank God for that, right? And we need to see that grace and that graciousness. On the last day, when the Lord casts the wicked into hell, there will be no one that has any compassion or pity for those who are lost. You may say, oh, that's awful. You know, That's a hard nose. That's an ungracious. That's just almost an unchristian thing to say. No, I'm sorry. On the last day, when the Lord casts the wicked into hell, Revelation says the saints will rejoice. We'll rejoice. Not because we want people to be lost, but because it will be so evident that it was against all of God's grace, in the face of His mercies, despite His extraordinary goodness, that the wicked have remained stubbornly, impenitently wicked. Right? Can you believe that God is saving Israel at this point? We would look at this story and say, they don't deserve to have God save them. Of course, they don't. And neither do you. And neither do I. Right? But that's what God does. And when God does bring judgment on Saul, we will not pity him. We will say, the Lord is righteous. His judgments are just. Verse 24. And the men of Israel had been hard pressed that day. So Saul laid an oath on the people, saying, cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies. So none of the people had tasted food. Now when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath, so he put out the tip of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. Then one of the people said, your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food this day. And the people were faint. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey? How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they found. For now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great. Or your translation may say something to the effect of, would it not have been much greater? In other words, it's not been all that it could have been. Now Saul's injunction on his soldiers here smacks of selfishness and pride. There seems to be a lack of clarity regarding the context of the conflict and the nature of his mission. This is Yahweh's battle, not Saul's. This, by the way, is a common leadership mistake. Right? The problem's not forceful leadership. That's not the problem. It's not to say that leaders should be soft. Leaders should always be gentle and sweet. No, that's not the problem. The problem is not that he's firm. The problem is that he's foolish. That he sees an advantage, he sees an opportunity, and he sees his men weakening, and his purpose is to bear down harder, and yet to do so in arrogance, in self-righteousness. Cursed be any man who eats food before tonight until I am avenged on my enemies. Whose enemies are we fighting? Whose battle is this? What is the possible purpose of an oath like this? I can understand if we want to say, guys, we're not going through the drive-thru today. We're not stopping for lunch. We're going to press the battle until we're done. But what is the possible advantage of saying, you better not put any food in your mouth, right? And if you chew a stick of gum, it better be low-calorie gum, right? I mean, that's just dumb. There's no possible advantage to this. This is the kind of oath that an arrogant man who is insecure in his leadership imposes upon the people. Now, I will say this, and we're going to see this at the end of chapter 14. Saul, in many ways, is an effective leader. That doesn't mean he's a good leader. Stalin was an effective leader. He wasn't a good leader. Adolf Hitler was a terrifically effective leader. An incredible public speaker. I mean, he could rally a nation, right? Not a good man. Not a good leader. Don't conflate or confuse effectiveness with righteous, right? Faithful. Saul is not a faithful leader. He is effective. I mean, after all, he terrifies his men so much that they walk into the forest, they see these wild honeycombs that have dropped out of the trees, and they are afraid to stoop down and taste it. Jonathan's not. Now, why is Jonathan unaware of this? Because Jonathan is not back behind the line, right, behind Israel's line, waiting around for his dad to get his act together and decide what we're going to do today, right? Jonathan's been out in front. Jonathan's the one who attacked the garrison. The army is trying to catch up to Jonathan, right? Jonathan doesn't know anything about this stuff. So what does he do? Sticks his staff down, stabs a piece of honeycomb, pulls it up, starts eating it. His eyes are brightened, right? He's got a rush of blood in his blood sugar, right? Feels good. And the people immediately say, Jonathan, don't you know what your father said? Your father pronounced a curse on anyone who would taste any food this day. Now, I am not sure that Jonathan's criticism of his father's policy in front of his men is wise. I am not certain that this is good judgment. And by the way, one of the things you need to remember as you're reading biblical narratives, even though in many texts like this one, you've got a clear good guy and a bad guy, doesn't mean that everything that the good guy does is good, and doesn't mean that everything that the bad guy does is bad, right? This is a narrative. This is a story. And so you don't always have the narrator saying, now, Saul, in all that he did, was unrighteous, and Jonathan, in all that he did, was acceptable, right? It may be unwise to criticize his father's policy in front of his men. But even if it was unwise, it was undeniably true. And if you want to study Saul's life from chapter 13 of 1 Samuel to chapter 31 when he dies, what you will see is that his leadership is characterized by foolishness, a lack of faith, self-righteousness, pride, and anger. I want you to think about something for a minute. How might a biblical perspective on the context and nature of our mission guard us against pride and self-righteousness and the legalistic tendencies to erect man-made harmful requirements? I want you to think about this for a minute. That people will ask me when I'm teaching classes in the community, they will say, do you have a church? And I say, no, Jesus has a church, but I get to work for him. Right? And they say, well, that's hair splitting. That's just being silly. Well, it's actually reinforcing an important point. This church doesn't belong to me. This isn't my church. I don't get to do in this church or with this church what I want. It's not the elders' church either, right? They may be the representatives that God has appointed to lead us, but that doesn't mean that it's their church or that they can do with it or in it whatever they want. This is Jesus' church. This is not about us. This is not about pressing the battle against our enemies. This is not about going out and winning victories for ourselves. But do you understand that is often how the church functions? I hope not this church, but if we're not careful, it easily could be. It's often how we see churches function. As if the church was a platform for promoting particular people, right? Maybe a dynamic pastor, or promoting certain persons in leadership, or promoting a name within the community, or within the larger world, right? We want a large stage. We want to exert our influence. That may be perfectly fine if you're a nonprofit charity organization that wants to do a lot of good the world over. It may be perfectly fine if you're a business that wants to extend your market influence into other regions. But it's got no place in the church. The church should be content, more than content, should desire to be faithful wherever God has placed them. And just be content to labor in obscurity. It doesn't matter. I saw somebody in Walmart yesterday, and they said, tell me again where your church is. And I told them, I said, yeah, I went over there. I didn't even see a sign. I said, no, we don't have a sign yet. We're working on it. Still, we're working on it. But did you see how many people were here on Sunday? Did you see how many people were received in the church 2 weeks ago? Do you see how many new visitors we have almost every week? Wow. I'm not saying we don't need a sign. But you do understand that the purpose of this program is not to draw attention to ourselves. It's not to have something that attracts people to us. We want people to see Christ. And it's going to be Christ that ultimately ensures that that is the case. Man-made rules, in this case, are not a path to victory. In fact, they undermine the greater law and work of God. And that, too, is something that we need to remember. Paul says in Colossians chapter 2, if you have been risen with Christ, why do you subject yourselves to rules? Do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things which perish with the using according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things have an appearance of wisdom, but not the truth. and they do not result in holiness, he says. And that's what we see with Saul's oath in this case. Well, verse 31, we continue to see the fallout from this foolishness. The Israelites struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Aijalon, and the people were very faint. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against Yahweh by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone to me here." And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, let every man among the people bring his ox or his sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against Yahweh by eating with the blood." So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to Yahweh. It was the first altar that he built to Yahweh. Remember I said that his leadership was a little too late? You know, too little too late? There you go. Where does Saul first build an altar to the Lord? After he has already lost his lineage. His dynasty is gone. And he is behaving like a self-righteous, arrogant tyrant. Now, the sin of the people here is that they're responsible for it. I'm not trying to change that. I'm not denying their responsibility. The law prescribed that if meat was going to be eaten, it had to be properly bled and prepared. And basically what they start doing is they butcher animals as they find them. They are taking animals from what would have been owned by the Philistines. They're killing them, they're gutting them, and they're pulling meat out. And if they're not eating it raw, they are not properly bleeding it. And that's the point, right? They may be eating it raw, but that's not the issue. It's that it's not properly bled and prepared.
Is that because of what Jonathan has said?
That's a good question. My sense is that it's because of they're just so hungry, right? The text says that the people are very faint, and so they just begin gorging themselves. As soon as the sun goes down and now the injunction is lifted, they go nuts, right? Right? So they've been fasting all day, they've been fighting all day, and now they just lose all discernment. They're responsible for that, but it would be foolish for us to not recognize that Saul's oath caused that sin. Saul is the stumbling block here, right? The New Testament uses a word for stumbling block, which is scandalon. Isn't that interesting? A scandal is a stumbling block. We talk about being offended, but in a biblical sense, to be offended means caused to sin. It's not about having your feelings hurt, you know? So if you come and you say, "Pastor, I don't like your shirt," or "I don't like, you know, your belt or your shoes," okay, that's fine. You know, you haven't offended me, both because I don't really care whether you like my shirt or not, but also because I've not been caused to sin, right? But when you put your people in a situation where their sin is almost inevitable, even though they are responsible for their sin, you are too. And Jesus says in Matthew chapter 18, verse 6, it would be better to have a millstone tied around your neck and to be thrown into the sea than to cause one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble. This is what he has in mind, to become a stumbling block to them. That's a terrifying thing. By the way, that passage only makes sense if there is something beyond death. It presupposes not only life after death, but eternal punishment. Do you see that? Otherwise, it makes no sense at all. But Jesus says, it would be better to die a terrifying death. Can you imagine? Right? I had a near-drowning experience when I was a kid. And decided I'd rather not die by drowning after that. It was frightening. I'm not making light of that, seriously. I mean, it was scary, right? But can you imagine having a millstone hung around your neck? So that as you're being thrown in, you know you're going to the bottom and you're not coming up. And you know the whole way down how this story ends. That's a frightening thing. Jesus says, better that than to be a stumbling block to a believer. We need a more robust fear of being a stumbling block to a brother or sister, right? Saul has no self-awareness. The people say to Saul here, the people, verse 33, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And Saul says, "This is on me. failure of leadership on my part. I have led the people of God into sin. God forgive me. Let's make this right. No, that's not what he says. That's what a leader, a man of God, a covenantly faithful king might have said. That's not what Saul says. He says, you have dealt treacherously. You are responsible for this. Well, yes, they've dealt treacherously. But do you see the lack of self-awareness? Jonathan Edwards, in his 70 resolutions that he composed as a very young man, began when he was 18 or 19 years old, completed them by the time he was 20 or 21. In his 70 resolutions, one of which I think is one of the ones we included in the pamphlet in the foyer, he resolved that every time he saw sin in another person, it would make him mindful of his own sin. Isn't that great? Isn't that appropriate? This is what Jesus is teaching us in Matthew chapter 7 when he says, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the log in your own eye? And I think there are two points about that. One, primarily in the context, he's talking about hypocritical judgment. He's saying you are disqualified from judging your brother, trying to remove the speck from his eye when you have a plank sticking out of your face, right? And that's Saul right here. The people have a speck in their eye. He has a log in his eye. But secondly, I think that Jesus is indicating something to us about the perspective, right? If you have an eyelash in your eye, it might as well be a chunk of wood, right? I mean, it blinds you. You know, I can't see clearly. It hurts, and it's a little hair, right? And that's how my sin should be. My sin should always be like a plank in my eye. And your sin should always, from my perspective, look like a speck, right? You see an eyelash in my eye, it doesn't look like a big deal, but it feels massive to me. There should be something about our perspective. Saul has none of that. He has no perspective on his sin. He just says, you have dealt treacherously. And now, in this, again, I hope I'm not judging him harshly. I hope I'm not misreading this text. In what seems to me to be only self-righteous, bring us great stone to me here. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make this right. I'm going to teach all of you people how you ought to have done this from the beginning. That's not leadership. That's a failure of leadership. A failure on the front end and now on the back end. There is no humility. There is no contrition. It is too little. It is too late. And that first altar erected by Saul is erected by a man whose administration is certainly not defined by its religious commitments or godliness. And then verse 36, then Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them. And they, the people, said, do whatever seems good to you. But the priest said, let us draw near to God here. And Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as Yahweh lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But there was not a man among all the people who answered him. Then he said to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan my son will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan my son, O Yahweh, God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in your people Israel, give Thummim. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Then Saul said, cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan. And Jonathan was taken. Okay, now we get to the real mystery of the text. Saul says, let's keep this going. You've had your meat. You've got your food. Let's keep fighting. We're going to go all night. Now, there are times where Israel marches all night, fights all night, and it's a really positive scene. Here, it just seems to be a man who is compounding bad decision on bad decision on bad decision, right? And the people say, whatever you want to do. They're willing to acquiesce. Whatever Saul wants. The priest says, I'll tell you what, we didn't finish asking God about his will earlier in the day. Why don't we try doing that now? Let's draw near to God now. This is the part of the story I cannot answer for you. I do not have an answer to this. I was in a lectureship at a Bible college years ago where an entire lecture was delivered on the subject of the Urim and Thummim, right? These are almost certainly two rocks or something like that, maybe a white stone and a black stone, something along those lines, that were placed inside the ephod of the high priest's, the pouch there, and they would draw it out, and it's what's called a binary method of judgment, right? In other words, you've got a yes and a no. You've got a one way or another. And at the end of the lecture, they opened up for a Q&A, and I raised my hand and asked this professor, I said, how does Saul know when the Lord is not answering him? And you could just see that it was a question that the presenter had not even considered and didn't have an answer for. I wish I did. I don't either. That's why I asked the question, right? I mean, will they just not come out? You know, does the priest reach in and they won't pull out? And he says, I don't think God's talking to us today. Or does he pull them out, but for some reason they know it's a false positive? I don't know the answer to that question. I think the answer probably involves this, and that is there was more than one way of inquiring of the Lord, although the Urim and Thummim seem to be the typical way in much of the Old Testament history. Okay, during this period, most of this inquiry is framed as a yes-no question, so that the Urim and Thummim could be used in this way. Regardless of how Saul knows that God is not answering him, the fact that he's not answering him is evident. Saul recognizes it, the priest recognizes it, that they are getting silence on the other end. God is not responding. And Saul also correctly identifies the fact that this is a sign of God's displeasure. But you and I should be able to recognize now what Saul does not recognize, and that is why God is displeased. See, Saul assumes that there is sin in the camp, and I would say, yeah, there's sin in the camp. But where is the sin properly located? This is why I say this is the mystery of the text. God identifies Jonathan. And I don't think Jonathan is the one who has sinned here. I think it's Saul. But we're not there yet. Let me get there. All right. So, Saul asks, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And God says nothing. And so Saul calls the people. Come here, all you leaders of the people. Know and see how this sin has arisen today. Do you hear the arrogance and the self-righteousness in this man? Is there even now any thought in his mind that perhaps he is the reason for God's silence? I don't think so. In fact, I think that's why he puts Jonathan and himself on one side and the people on the other. Because he knows it's not with us. He knows it's among the people. Except it's not among the people. How in the world can this be? They cast lots, and Saul and Jonathan are taken. Therefore Saul said, verse 21, O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan my son, O Yahweh, God of Israel, give a ring. Sure enough, Saul and Jonathan are taken, and then they cast lots again, and Jonathan is taken. Why does the Lord identify Jonathan? I think the answer is to find the guilt that Saul was looking for. Saul is convinced that some ritual violation has occurred that has prompted this. In his mind, most likely, he has in mind this curse, this oath, don't eat until the sun goes down. The eating with the blood we've already dealt with. That must be the curse that has been violated. And so God gives him the answer he's looking for. Yeah, Jonathan is the one who violated that oath. Now the question is, does God view that as a violation? I don't think so. I don't see any way of believing so. But we're dealing with Old Testament narrative. It's not as though the narrator explains all of this. I think that Saul gets exactly the answer that he's looking for. And there is a parallel here, if that's the case, to see. Do you remember that a few weeks ago I told you, be careful what you ask for, be careful what you pray for? That sometimes God rewards sin with sin. That sometimes God punishes us by giving us the very things that in our arrogance and our selfishness we seek. We saw that with the people. They say, we want a king. And the Lord says, Samuel, you tell them what a king's going to do to them. They say, we don't care. We want a king. God says, okay, I'll give you a king. I'm going to give you a king exactly like the one you want. Saul says, there's sin in the camp, and whoever it is going to die tonight. Even if it's Jonathan, my son. Of course, it's not Jonathan, my son. But even if it's Jonathan, my son, he's going to die tonight. The Lord says, okay. You want to find out who violated your silly little ritual vow? Jonathan. He gives Saul the fruit of his own foolishness. Verse 43. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And Jonathan told him, I tasted a little honey with the tip of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I will die. And Saul said, God do so to me and more also. You shall surely die, Jonathan. Hard for me to see that as anything other than taking the Lord's name in vain. Then the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As Yahweh lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. They ransomed Jonathan. You know what that suggests, don't you? There's a sacrifice. Something dies that night, but it's not Jonathan. They redeem him. The law prescribes ways of doing this, right? The firstborn son belongs to me. You redeem him by a sacrifice. You redeem him by a sacrifice. They ransomed Jonathan from Saul's wrath that night. Viola.
It just seems to me that he was just looking for somebody to punish.
He's looking for a scapegoat.
Yeah.
But he's not seeing that he's the problem. He is completely blind, self-deceived to the fact that he is the problem, right? And I think that's why God brings them to this moment. Now, I'm not crazy about the people's rationalization here, by the way. You know, their argument doesn't seem very sound. Well, Jonathan has accomplished great things. God has blessed us with great things. Therefore, Jonathan shouldn't die. I don't think Jonathan should die either, but I'm not sure that that's the reason. But what do they say? He's worked with God. God is the one who has given us victory. You are not going to do this today. Up until now, the people have been a lot like their king. At least they have the character today to withstand their king. It raises some interesting questions that we're going to have to clip through pretty quickly here. Did you know that God requires men to honor foolish oaths that do not involve explicit or ongoing sin? Joshua chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In Joshua chapter 9, the Israelites swear to the Gibeonites peace. And they were inhabitants of Canaan proper. And the law of God had said you are not to make a treaty of peace with them. And yet when that treaty is violated by Saul during his reign, God requires blood to pay the debt for that sin. He holds them to that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, some Christians are married to non-Christians. Did you know that that's wrong? You're not supposed to marry a non-Christian. And you know what Paul says? Remain married. If the unbeliever is willing to remain with you, remain married. You're to be faithful in because that's a foolish oath, but it doesn't involve ongoing sin. So be faithful where you are. You made a vow that you shouldn't have made, but honor that. God requires that, but not in all cases. God does not require us to honor oaths that obligate us to further sin. So you say, Pastor, I became very angry, and I swore that I was going to kill my neighbor. And I believe that a person should keep his oaths to God. You know? Say, no. No, that's not the kind of vow that God even allows you to fulfill. That's essentially what Saul is doing here. That's why I say, back up in verse 44, God do so to me and more also, God is going to do so and more to Saul. He's going to have his body fall on the battlefield with the Philistines and then be maimed and hung up as a trophy on a wall. for the enemies of God to celebrate over. God will do so and more to Saul. He takes God's name in vain. Because what he is saying is, may God empower me to do something unrighteous, unholy, wicked. And God does not empower people to do that. God does not require men to keep such oaths. And we need to be careful about making vows to God beyond what Scripture requires. There is a place for doing so, but they are often contaminated by sinful motivations and end up complicating our lives tremendously. We have an entire chapter in our confession, Westminster Confession chapter 22, on this subject. So I would recommend that for just further study. And then finally, verse 47. When Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them, and he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. This note about Saul's further military campaigns is placed here, I think, because the focus of the narrative is about to shift. Chapter 15 shows the utter rejection of Saul as king. Chapter 16 is the anointing of David. From this point forward, the focus is on Saul's fall and David's ascension. And so this is the right place to put this. This summary looks at Saul's administration as a whole, right? The whole length of his reign. It's a summary. And basically, what it tells us is that Saul, his reign was characterized by warfare the whole time, and that from a military perspective, from a historical perspective, he was fairly effective. We said earlier, Stalin was an effective leader. He wasn't a good one. Hitler was an effective leader. He wasn't a good one. Saul, historically, is an effective leader, but not a good one. The prolonged conflicts of Saul's reign altered the nature of military service in Israel. No longer would militias be adequate for the nation's defense. That has been the case up until now. Now a standing army and conscription was required, just as the prophet Samuel warned in chapter 8, verses 10 through 18. I want to finish with this application. How do we want to be remembered? In what arena do we think that success is important? Dale Ralph Davis, in his commentary on 1 Samuel, I think does a nice job with this. He says, which is the right assessment of Saul? You've got this historical assessment in these final verses, and then you've got the broader covenantal assessment. In terms of the historical and military realm, Saul is a success. In terms of the covenantal realm, he's a failure. And he basically says, which one's correct? And he says, they're both correct. But only one of them is important, right? They're both true depictions, but only one of them actually matters. You have to know what your values are to know how you ought to live your life. And many Christians are living their lives in a way that is different from what they say their priorities really are. What their values really are. In other words, their priorities don't line up with their values. They say what's important is covenant faithfulness, but they're living their lives as if military faithfulness, right? Historical success is what's really important. At the end of Saul's life, I mean, it's tragic. You say, here was a man who was so gifted, who was so blessed, God gave him all of these victories. He ultimately dies in shame under the wrath of God. What was the value of all that success? You know, at Saul's memorial service, you say, well, he won a lot of battles. You know, he reigned a long time. He was a really tall guy. You know, I mean, what do you say? Those aren't the kinds of things that we want to say. You want to say he was a faithful father. He was a man of God. He was a man who lived by faith, who lived his life in hope, right? If you don't know what is important, you cannot know how you ought to live. And a lot of Christians are pursuing success in the wrong arena. And we need to think about that. Because Saul's life is kind of a warning against that. Right here at the end of chapter 14, it says, you know, from one vantage point, Saul was a great success. You know what happens in the next chapter? The Lord says, because you have rejected me, I have rejected you from being king over Israel. I'm going to find another one. You know, which assessment do you want to be true of you? The assessment at the end of chapter 14 of his military and political victories, or God's assessment? Right? Yeah, I think that speaks for itself.